Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. As a young law student, Mahvesh Khan believed in an American justice system. She volunteered as an interpreter at Guantanamo Bay, believing that even the worst of the worst had the right to be represented fairly. But instead of finding terrorists, she found goat herders, politicians, and reputable physicians trapped in a broken justice system with no way out. This hour On Point, human stories from Guantanamo Bay. You can join the conversation. What lessons do you take from the stories coming out of Guantanamo, from the trials and the reports of torture? Later this hour, we'll be joined by the Washington Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers, who edited the recent investigative series on the U.S. detention system. But first, joining me from San Diego is Mahvesh Khan. She is an interpreter for detainees at Guantanamo Bay and author of the new book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Mahvesh, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So how is it that you made your way to Guantanamo Bay?
Well, my interest began while I was still a law student studying Guantanamo, and I was studying the federal torture statutes, and I just remember being outraged when I realized that this Gitmo Detention Center was created just to weasel around cornerstone constitutional principles that America was founded upon. And that's what initially started my interest. And I thought that Guantanamo was sort of a charade, a lawless black hole where men were being hidden from the public and the press. And after studying about it in my international law class, I ended up Googling the cases that I was studying. And I got in touch with the attorneys, and I offered myself as a Pashto interpreter because I grew up speaking Pashto, which is a language that's spoken in Afghanistan and in northern Pakistan. And at the time, there was no one who spoke Pashto with security clearance, so the Afghan detainees at Guantanamo were unable to communicate with their lawyers. And that's initially how I got involved.
Hmm. So you started your translation work for the prisoners at Guantanamo in January 2006?
That's right.
And despite security precautions, you took notes during these interactions, and you were translating for prisoners whom the government described as the worst of the worst. Is that right?
That's right. I took notes, but all of my notes were submitted to the Department of Defense for security, like just clearance to make sure there was no classified information. And once they were cleared, I was able to print them in my book.
Tell us some of the stories that you did print in your book. First, the pediatrician for whom you translated, Ali Shah Musovi.
That's right. The first time I went to the base, I was afraid I was going to meet somebody who was a terrorist or al-Qaeda, and I was nervous. And the first detainee that I met was Dr. Ali Shah Musovi, who was a pediatrician, and he worked for the United Nations. And it was definitely an interesting first meeting.
In what way?
Well, I went there expecting to meet a terrorist because that's all that I had known in the media. That's all that I was told, that these men were the worst of the worst. I was afraid that I was, you know, going to meet somebody who wouldn't necessarily want to look at me because I was a woman. And I had all of these biases in my head. And I remember walking into that meeting room and seeing a man who looked equally nervous as I was, perhaps because, you know, he was expecting to meet an interrogator and I expecting to meet a terrorist. And he was standing there in the far corner of the room with his legs shackled to the floor. And the more I learned about him through that meeting room and through research about him, the less it made sense of why Dr. Ali Shah was at Guantanamo.
Why? What did he tell you?
Well, he was a pediatrician. He was accused of being Taliban, as a member of the Taliban. And yet this man worked for the United Nations to help increase Afghan electoral support in the new democracy. And during the Taliban's rule, he fled Afghanistan because he was a Shiite Muslim. And Shiite Muslims were persecuted by the Taliban, who are Sunni, a different religious sect. Mm-hmm. And beyond that, I mean, the way his family was, it just made no sense. His wife was an economist. He wanted his daughter to go to school, and they fled Afghanistan during the rule of the Taliban. And he was in full support of the Karzai regime and only went back to Afghanistan to open up health clinics and to work for the UN to help increase, you know, Afghan electoral support in the new democracy that America initiated.
And so how was it that he was taken to Guantanamo Bay?
Well, he doesn't know. He believes that, you know, he could have been sold into captivity. The U.S. airdropped thousands of leaflets all across Afghanistan when we first invaded. And these leaflets offered up to $25,000 per member of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda. And when you offer such a huge amount of money in Afghanistan, it's like winning the Super Lotto jackpot for locals, because the average Afghan makes about 80 cents a day, which is about $300 a year. And that kind of money is, it's a huge sum. And beyond that, Afghans have a history of tribal, political, ethnic, and all sorts of feuds that go back generations. And it created this incentive for locals to turn one another in. And Dr. Ali Shah came from a pretty prominent family in Gardez, Afghanistan, and he wanted to run for parliament in the new administration. And so it's speculated that political opponents could have turned him in, or he was sold for this huge amount of money.
And how did he describe to you, or what did he tell you about how he was treated at Guantanamo?
Well, he described all sorts of abuse, which started at Bagram Air Base, which is north of Kabul in Afghanistan. And he described being, you know, beaten, being forced to experience extremes of heat and cold, being punched and kicked, called a terrorist. The female members of his family were, you know, insulted, his religion, his nationality, and he was paraded around naked. He was forced into all sorts of stress positions for hours, and just humiliated and experienced all sorts of indignities.
His story has common threads with another prisoner that you met. I think it was the second prisoner that you met, Hajdi Nusrat Khan.
That's right.
And what was his story?
The second prisoner that I met at Guantanamo was this 80-year-old man. And, you know, I was nervous about meeting the first detainee, who ended up being a pediatrician. And then I went through that nervousness the second day thinking, you know, that was just one guy. And the second prisoner I met was this 80-year-old man. He couldn't walk without assistance. He didn't see very well. He had a whole list of just ailments, and he kept telling us that, you know, if I've done something wrong, put me before the world in a public trial. Why am I being hidden in Guantanamo? Why aren't journalists allowed to tell my story? And it was heartbreaking for me to see this 80-year-old man who there was no evidence against that he had done anything criminal. And he kept telling us that his own son was a senator in Karzai's parliament, that they were supporters of the American democracy, that they had done nothing wrong. And it was difficult for me in that second meeting to see this man who could have been anybody's grandfather sitting there without any charges or allegations that he had done anything wrong, and there was no evidence to suggest that he did.
So these are two stories, Malvej Khan, from the prisoners that you translated for at Guantanamo Bay. What are the common threads that connect the other stories of the prisoners that you interviewed there?
Most of the prisoners that I met at Guantanamo, For the most part, there was no evidence to suggest that they had done anything criminal. I mean, none of the men that I met had any semblance of criminal activity or terrorism. There was one individual who admitted to have worked for the Taliban, but he said that he was a low-level, you know, check post guard, and he equated it with, you know, an individual who works for the State Department, that, you know, just because you work for a government of the country does not mean that you're taking part in its foreign policy, and that an individual who necessarily works for the Bush administration in the State Department doesn't mean that they're in line with its foreign policy. And that was his position. But for the most part, every other detainee, there was no evidence of criminal activity. They came from a whole variety of different professions, and their personalities were so distinct. Across the board, they spoke about abuse at Bagram Air Base at the hands of U.S. soldiers, and they missed their families and spoke about the injustices of just being held without being charged.
And yet you concede in the book that it may appear to readers that you, quote, gave ample and perhaps naive credence to the prisoners' points of view. I mean, is it possible that any of these prisoners ever lied to you?
Sure. And I've stated that in the book. The purpose of the book was to give them a voice, because Guantanamo Bay is a place that is hidden from the world. It's held away from the press. And in establishing the detention center and the interrogation camps at Guantanamo, President Bush took deliberate and calculated steps to ensure that the detainees didn't have access to lawyers or the courts, and held away from the press. And the point of the book was to profile them, give them a voice, and air their perspectives. I did meet individuals who sometimes told me that, you know, they couldn't read or write, and then 2 months later they were reading and writing flawlessly, but there was never any evidence that I saw that suggested that they were Al-Qaeda or terrorists. And, you know, to even say that they were innocent is a strange word, because they were never charged to begin with, so what are they innocent of? And Americans were, you know, simply just unaware of the bounties, and 86% of the detainees, according to unclassified DOD documents, were brought to Guantanamo at a time when locals were benefiting financially from the bounty program.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the personal stories of Guantanamo Bay inmates. Mavesh Khan is with us. She is an interpreter for detainees at Guantanamo Bay and author of the new book, My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. I'd like to go to the phones for a moment. We have a couple of good callers who want to join us. Jack is on the line from North Carolina. Hi, Jack. Welcome to On Point.
Hello, Jay. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Go ahead.
I served in Afghanistan, where we were tasked with the collection of some of these detainees that she's referring to. And it is true that a lot of them did have jobs and are educated. But it is also true that they were carrying weapons and they were firing upon us. If the situation was reversed, and would she be there, you know, at a prison in Afghanistan trying to get the American story? Right now, if you put these same prisoners in a regular prison in America, what type of situation are we looking at then, especially after September 11th? I'm thinking that Guantanamo is a safer place for them than it would be in an American prison. Thank you.
Jack, thank you for your call. Mavesh, would you respond? There's Jack who says
sure.
These folks were carrying
absolutely.
Weapons. They were firing on the soldiers.
And if the situation was reversed, I would absolutely still condone that the prisoners should have a fair trial, because that's the only way to determine whether they were involved in any criminal activity or not. And the fact of the matter is 86% of the detainees at Guantanamo, according to a Seton Hall University based on unclassified Department of Defense data, is that they were there because locals turned them in. It had nothing to do with United States intelligence on them fighting in a battlefield. And, you know, a lot of them were fleeing Afghanistan into Pakistan, where Pakistani police turned them in. There was a black market to earn thousands of dollars, $25,000. And when there was no investigation followed up, it's hard to determine who was, in fact, really fighting on the battlefield, firing upon U.S. soldiers, and who was simply caught up in these political, local, and tribal feuds of, you know, individuals who were standing to benefit hugely financially. And in terms of how to deal with them in a civilian court, we've dealt with this in the past. We've had terrorism suspects tried on U.S. soil in the first World Trade Center bombing. And We have ways of dealing with classified information, and to set up this new system of Guantanamo and to keep everything in secrecy away from the press and the public is fundamentally very anti-American and unpatriotic of the way this administration is operating.
Mavesh, how many of the prisoners for whom you translated, many of whom were held without trial, you say in the book, sometimes even without charges, how many of them were ultimately released?
I don't know the exact figure, but it's a great majority. Guantanamo, at its inception, had about 770 detainees. Today, it's about 250, about. And those that were released were never charged. So the subset that I was interpreting for and working with, I represent one client supervised. They, you know, a lot of them have been released without ever having been charged.
Could you describe the emotions of the lawyers that you worked with, the lawyers for whom you translated in this process?
The emotions?
Yes. And in many cases, as you describe in the book, the anger of many of them who failed to get justice for their clients.
Sure. Some of the attorneys were very angry because it's a difficult place to work under as an attorney. The administration is constantly trying to throw up obstacles for attorneys, and it's frustrating. Often we have to wait for hours before we're allowed to even sit down with the detainee, and they ask questions of, you know, why am I here? Why aren't I allowed a regular trial? And it's frustrating for attorneys because they're operating in a completely different system. And
how were you accepted, Mavesh, as a woman at Guantanamo?
Well, I was initially afraid that it would be a problem because all I'd heard was that these men were Taliban, and I had a certain image of what the Taliban were like. But the individuals that I met were very warm and receptive, and a lot of them treated me like I was a daughter. They called me Bache, which means my child or sister. And I grew to care about a lot of the detainees. And to me, they've become like friends or like surrogate brothers and, you know, fathers. And I keep in touch with many of them who have been released and have found that they were, in fact, who they said they were. And their stories have panned out. And we've developed, you know, incredible friendships. And some of the detainees, you know, Donald Rumsfeld has famously called them the worst of the worst. But if I had children, I would have allowed them to watch my kids. And they were not the worst of the worst, but some of them were, in fact, the best of the best. They were incredibly hospitable and charitable individuals. Dr. Ali Shah wanted to build health clinics in his war-torn country. And I think that because they've been held in Guantanamo, far away from the public, we're unable to recognize them as individuals, as human beings. They're known as this, you know, nameless, faceless entity of foreigners, and they've been serial numbered. Not even the guards know their names. Each of them has a number, and not knowing their names makes their abuse and indefinite detention more palatable.
Let me welcome some callers into this conversation, have some questions and comments for you. Chris is on the line now from Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I just have a comment. I'm a CASA, court-appointed special advocate in Mass. And in that role, I interview foster children, parents, lawyers, social workers, school officials. And I'm always shocked by how different the stories are. I mean, our motto as CASAs is trust but verify. And I'm really concerned that the author hasn't been able to get the whole story, because I suspect that, although I'm sure there are some innocent, plenty of innocent people in Guantanamo Bay, I suspect that if you're able to talk to the people on the U.S. side who really know what's going on, that the stories about a lot of these people would be a whole lot different. And I'll take my comments off the air. Thank you.
Chris, thank you. Would you respond, Mavesh?
Sure. The fact of the matter is, out of almost 800 prisoners at Guantanamo, today there's about 250, And those hundreds have been released, have never been charged by the U.S. military, the people who allegedly know what's going on. And beyond that, I have never said that I believe everybody at Guantanamo is innocent. I don't believe that. I do believe that there are evil men at Guantanamo who are, you know, guilty of terrorism acts, such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and, you know, the alleged 9/11 mastermind. I've never stated that I believed everybody at Guantanamo was innocent. And the only thing I've advocated for is a fair trial for all of them, because that's the only way of separating the good from the bad. We've been able to do this on U.S. soil in civilian courts before. And the book simply gives them a voice, something that every alleged rapist and murderer in America has. And it's, you know, it's a way for Americans to get to know these men, and they've been hidden from the U.S. and the world public and press. And that was the point, to give them a perspective and to humanize them, to tell their sides of the stories, because all we've heard about them is that there's these monsters and bomb makers. And that's what that was my feeling when I initially went in, as the caller feels, and how wrong I was.
Malvesh, hold on just a moment. I'd like to bring another voice into our conversation at this point. Joining me now from Washington, D.C. is John Walcott. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers and editor for the series Guantanamo Beyond the Law, which was published in June after an 8-month investigation in 11 countries. You'll find links to the whole series on our website, onpointradio.org. John Walcott, nice to have you with us. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
How do Mavesh Khan's accounts line up with the exhaustive reporting that you and your McClatchy reporters did?
Almost perfectly. What we found is that at least dozens and probably hundreds of men were imprisoned either at Bagram or Kandahar in Afghanistan or later at Guantanamo, on the basis of completely fabricated evidence, bounty payments, or half-baked evidence. In many cases, they were turned in by tribal rivals, personal rivals, people who had it in for them, and Americans who often didn't speak the language, didn't know the culture, simply took the word of their informants. And as Moves has very eloquently said, we constructed more or less out of thin air our own version of the Napoleonic Code, in which all these people were guilty until they could prove themselves innocent, and then denied them any way to do that. And so there they sat in miserable conditions. The other thing we found that Moves may not have seen if she was at Guantanamo is that the treatment of prisoners in Afghanistan at the air bases at Bagram and Kandahar was far worse than what prisoners at Guantanamo received. And we heard that over and over again from the 67 former detainees, including Nusrat Khan, who she mentioned earlier, whom we tracked down and interviewed.
One of our callers brought up, and I know others are here waiting to ask the same question, is there a danger here at taking prisoners' stories at face value? And how did your reporters verify what they were hearing from these prisoners?
Well, you know, reporters never take stories at face value, no matter where they come from, and that's a lesson that we learn over and over again, whether it's about prisoners at Guantanamo or WMD in Iraq. And so in an effort to track this down, we talked to American officials. We looked at all the paperwork, tribunal records and so on, that we could get our hands on. But ultimately, what was most interesting was when we went back to Afghanistan and talked to Afghan officials, who are America's allies in what's becoming an increasingly nasty war against a resurgent Taliban. And our own Afghan allies, in many cases, told us, no, this was the wrong guy. This guy was working for us. One of the guys we found was, in fact, guarding a fuel depot for the U.S.-backed Afghan government when one of his enemies turned him in. And that, I think he was in custody for 2 or 3 years at least. And as near as we could tell from his own tale, corroborated by local officials who are allied with the United States, he had done absolutely nothing wrong. And as Moves pointed out, at the end of the day, hundreds of these people have been released, which I think tells you a good deal about the quality of the evidence against them.
At this point, let me bring another caller into this conversation. John is on the line now from Fort Bragg in North Carolina. Hi, John. Welcome to the program. Thanks for calling. Are you there, John? I guess we lost him. Let's go to Patrick, who's on the line from Kings Tree, South Carolina. Hi, Patrick. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Thanks for calling.
I want to thank your guest for speaking out. I think, you know, this is a vital issue to America, and our whole integrity, sense of integrity, and what it means to be an American is compromised by the actions of the administration. But I'm aware, I've done a lot of research on this, I've spoken to legislators on this subject and written on this subject, and on behalf of Amnesty, I went to my congressman, and I want to ask the guests two questions. Number one, what do you think Americans can do to influence our policy? And second, how do you think America's sense of integrity and sense of, you know, the country being on the right track, how do you think it's been affected by Guantanamo and the other examples of mistreatment?
Patrick, thank you for the call. Patrick's question, let me turn to Mavesh first for the first part of his question. What can America do now to influence policy at Guantanamo Bay, given the stories that you and John Walcott have told us? Mavesh?
Well, the prisoners at Guantanamo have been hidden from the public and from the press largely, and I feel that average Americans, the best that they can do is make noise, you know, write op-eds to your local newspapers, and, you know, if writing to your congressman doesn't work, because using the press is a powerful tool towards shaming the government into change. So I would suggest that as a start.
And John Walcott, the caller's second point, what is Guantanamo Bay and what's happened there affect the integrity of our country and the sense of us being on the right track or not?
Well, there's no question that it's done enormous damage to us around the world, with our allies and our adversaries alike, who point to it as evidence that we are less moral than we claim to be and therefore have no authority to tell anyone else how to treat their prisoners or how to behave. So it's done enormous damage. But I'd make one more point, which I think is important, and that is that at some point in a democracy, all of our institutions, including the press, need to be held accountable for what they've done. And the work that Moves has done, and I hope the work that our reporters at McClatchy did, is a step in that direction. As Moves said, a great deal of this has been hidden from the American public. It now needs to be dug out, and those responsible need to be identified and held accountable for what they've done. And if they've crossed lines, then that needs to be dealt with. We don't know that yet. There's far more we don't know about this, and particularly about the genesis of it, despite Jane Mayer's very good recent book. But officials, the people responsible for this, especially at the highest levels, need to be held accountable.
Mavesh, a few seconds here for you to respond.
I absolutely agree with John, and you know, our image as a beacon of justice has been eroded. And I'm sometimes accused of being anti-American, but I feel that speaking out for your country and what our constitutional principles and what this country has been founded upon is all about being American. And it's very important that we get back on the right track, because we're not an adequate model for developing countries and torturing prisoners with these medieval torture techniques that were once upon a time called Chinese water torture and today waterboarding, but it's all the same. And the fundamental point of the book is to show that we're a lot more alike than we are different, and not knowing who these prisoners are makes their abuse, you know, easier.
The This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're speaking this hour about the stories and the lessons that come out of Guantanamo Bay. Mavesh Khan is with us. She is an interpreter for detainees at Guantanamo Bay and author of the new book, My Guantanamo Diary. John Walcott is also with us. He's the Washington Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers and editor of the five-part investigative series, Guantanamo Beyond the Law. I'd like to go back to the phones now. John from Fort Bragg, North Carolina, called back and is with us now on the line. John, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm just curious as to, with regards to international law and Geneva Conventions, if we recover prisoners on a battlefield who are armed and but are not in uniform, what exactly is it we're supposed to do with them?
Okay. I see on my note here you've served several times in Afghanistan.
Right. I'm getting ready to return to Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And one thing I've noticed as the years have passed on, our rules of engagement have become more stricter, and it's more difficult for us to call for support. And we always have the inherent right to self-defense, of course, but, you know, when you're fighting anybody without regard to insurgency, conventional war, you know, you want to be aggressive, because at the end of the day, you want to come back with all the people and your team come back. And, you know, I'm starting to ramble, I think. But,
well,
I guess what I was really asking was just, what is it that they feel we should do with people who are recovered on the battlefield who are not in uniform and are armed? Because it's pretty specific in the Geneva Conventions that they should be regarded as spies. It's commonly held that spies are shot during time of war or put to death.
I hear your point. That comes from a soldier right out of his mouth, John Walcott. What do you say to that? What are the rules? We're in a new age now, huh?
Well, the first thing I'd say to John is to thank him for his service.
Yeah.
What we are asking our men and women to do in places like Afghanistan is extraordinarily difficult, and there's about 1% of the population that is doing that for the other 99% of it. So whatever differences we have, still, thank you, John, for serving our country. This is not a new problem. We dealt with this in Vietnam, where the enemy often showed up in black pajamas, wearing entire treads on his feet, not in uniform. But if he's carrying a weapon, I think it's a little hard to throw him into the spy category. That's kind of a giveaway if you're trying to spy on somebody. So I don't see why those people should be denied Geneva protections. If they're carrying a weapon and they are hostile, particularly if they're using the weapon, why not accord them all of the Article 5 and other Geneva protections and deal with them? Why do we have to construct a system that is completely new and unknown and untested, I might add, in the courts? And virtually every test that's come up, it's failed. Why not simply treat them the way we would treat prisoners of war? I don't see the downside to that is the problem. I don't see why so much of this was deemed necessary. There are some other cases that were not caught on battlefields, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds and others who are a little harder. But if a guy's captured on a battlefield, as far as the law is concerned, I think he's a prisoner of war. And I don't understand why we wouldn't simply treat him that way.
Here's another question and another point from Mike, who's in Hudson, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
I've got a couple of quick comments here.
Okay.
And the first thing I wanted to ask is, could somebody tell me what a terrorist looks like? I mean, is he a dentist? Is he a truck driver? Is he an auto repair person? And the reason I ask that is that at the beginning of the program, what you're doing is you're humanizing these people. These people in their own society have cut off heads and arms. And yet, we can't define what a terrorist is. So I'd like to hear from them. And I also have a couple other quick comments, too. And the one thing is about Americanizing them. You're making them sound like these people live next door to us in America. And you're telling us that we should accord them what we would accord our neighbor.
You're saying they don't have the same rights we do. I hear your point, Mike, and I want to turn to Mavesh Khan to have her respond to that. Go ahead.
Well, you know, to say that they are terrorists and to dehumanize them without any evidence of the fact is flawed. I mean, if they are in fact terrorists, because we don't know what terrorists look like, give them a trial and let the evidence play it out, because there have been terrorists tried on U.S. soil, as I've said before, and we have ways of determining whether individuals have engaged in terrorist activity or not. But the fact of the matter is 86% of the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are there because locals turned them in because they had their own issues with individuals based on tribal and ethnic, you know, conflicts that went back generations. And to just rely on the word of the Department of Defense that they're the worst of the worst and they're bomb makers is fundamentally unfair. And just because they are not U.S. citizens doesn't mean they're human beings and they should be picked up from their beds at night and locked up. How would the caller feel if this was a member of his family being picked up by a foreign invader and locked up indefinitely without ever being charged? My argument has been that these individuals should be charged and should be tried as other terror suspects have been in the past. And if we find them guilty of terrorism, of acts of terrorism, then lock them up.
We have another member of the military on the line now from Fort Gordon, Georgia. White is calling. Hi, White. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead.
Back to the other military caller, I've done several tours in Iraq, and the whole thing is, I think really the question to be asked is, when you have journalists getting involved in something that, you know, we're trying to find out who is combatant and who is non-combatant, and like the author had said, and even the other journalists had said that, you know, a lot of these people are innocent, well, you know, when you're on patrol, you cannot pick out who is a combatant, who isn't a combatant, and when you have your, you know, the Mukhtars and the different tribal leaders telling you that this guy's a bad guy, and that's all the information you have to go on, it's like, you know, you not detain them and risk, you know, catching an IED on a convoy or, you know, sniper fire or indirect fire on your base and getting soldiers killed, or do you go on that information and detain them and possibly that maybe one out of 20 that you do detain is really a bad guy, and unfortunately in that process you've detained innocent people. It happens every day in the U.S. You know, over there it comes down to trying to find the bad guys and trying to avoid getting circle talk from, you know, the tribal leaders and their family members or friends when you do detain them about them not being a bad guy, and some of them do turn out to be bad guys. The whole point here that I'm trying to ask is, you know, what are we supposed to do with information that we get, and when we grab these guys and, you know, they're, you know, being made out like, you know, they were detained and held as captives, you know, as detainees, and they're innocent. What do you do? You know.
Yeah, I hear your point, White, and I sure appreciate your call there from Fort Gordon. John Walcott, you hear the caller. There he is, right in the middle of it, serving our country as a member of the military. These are difficult calls to make, he's saying.
Well, they are, but they're not really. It really shouldn't be his job to decide if he's out leading a platoon or commanding a company. You know, I think he is entitled, in order to protect himself and his men, to round up anybody who looks suspicious, acts suspicious, or is said to be suspicious. That's not a judicial proceeding, and it's not for him to decide down the road. He's got another job to do, as he said, you know, keeping his men safe from IEDs and VBIEDs and so on. What we lacked was any system to sort out the people that did get rounded up this way and separate the innocent from the guilty.
And how did that happen? How did we end up without that system?
That started, as near as we can determine at the moment, in the White House, where a determination was made that everybody was a suspected enemy combatant. And to go back to the earlier questioner, none of these people had any rights under U.S. or international law. There was a gray area created in which these people had no right to defend themselves, no right to see the evidence against them, no right to call witnesses in their own defense, and therefore no way to prove their innocence. So they were simply presumed guilty, and held indefinitely, and in many cases mistreated. The real tragedy of this, for a soldier in Iraq or in Afghanistan especially, is that this system has probably created more enemies than it has taken off the streets. Because all of these innocent people have families. The hundreds whom we've had to release have gone home and told everyone within earshot what happened to them. And that has generated more anger against the United States than we started out with. And if that has put men like the two callers in greater jeopardy, then, to go back to what I said earlier, someone needs to be held accountable for that.
There's a caller on the line who would like to speak to that very point. Daniel is in Beaufort, South Carolina. Hi, Daniel. Welcome.
Yes, hello. That speaks almost to what I was wanting to ask your guest of the relationships that she's maintained of the people who've been released without charge. What is their attitude now? Maybe she could describe some of them, how they feel after being released.
Mahvesh Khan, thanks, Daniel, for your call. You reunited with several of the prisoners after their release. What were they thinking? What were they feeling back home after they had endured this?
Well, of the individuals that I met at Guantanamo who were released, they were very happy just to be home. They were happy to be with their families, and I witnessed no hostility towards the United States. Surely some of them may have anger. For example, Dr. Ali Shah has... His family has set up the health clinics that he wanted to, and Haji Nusrat is back home in Sarabi, Afghanistan, and, you know, his son is a senator in the Karzai administration. The overwhelming sentiment has been that they're just very happy to be home.
Does that surprise you, John Walcott, based on what you said previously?
It doesn't, but we found other instances. We found one guy who was an ordinary thug in the Zormat district in eastern Afghanistan. He was into kidnapping and extortion, all sorts of bad stuff. He was not Al-Qaeda. He was not a terrorist. He was preying on his own people. But when we got done with him, when he was released from Guantanamo after 12 months or so, he had become a Taliban leader. And in fact, the Defense Intelligence Agency had him in their stack of 20 most wanted militants in Afghanistan and Pakistan. He was number 16 in the deck, which had Osama bin Laden at the top. And so, unfortunately, what we found was that the last stage of this process, we put these innocent people shoulder to shoulder with some true bad guys in Guantanamo. And the bad guys, the Islamic militants, took advantage of that to preach their gospel of hatred of America, their notion that Judaism and Christianity are at war with Islam, and it's a war for survival, and that suicide bombing is justified, and so on and so forth. And so one of the articles in our series, if you go in and read it, it's the day three story, is called A School for Jihad, because unfortunately that's what Guantanamo became.
Another question here that we can squeeze in before the end of our hour. Jane, who's in Hull, Massachusetts. Hi, Jane. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I have two questions for Mahvesh. The first is, I was wondering if she had been an interpreter before she went and to Afghanistan, and I mean to Guantanamo, and worked with these prisoners. And I'd like to know what instructions she received from her employers, because normally interpreters, at least in the legal profession, are not supposed to play a triage or content gathering role. And I was wondering if the fact that she's a lawyer then permitted her to write her book and get around all those kinds of restrictions that might be put on a regular interpreter. And I just wanted to say that this is in the larger context of other interpreters encountering these legal problems when they see that the people for whom they're interpreting are in sort of situations that are difficult, such as the Pottsville raid by the Immigration Services in Iowa that happened a few months ago.
Jane, thanks for your call. Let's squeeze in Mahvesh with an answer here. Go ahead.
No, I'm not a professional interpreter. I've never interpreted before. I grew up speaking Pashto at home and just used that as a basis of helping the habeas attorneys who were involved. I did grow to represent somebody under supervised legal counsel. However, the attorneys that I was working with, they were very supportive of my book, and they helped in unclassifying notes and submitting notes to the Department of Defense. And my role extended from being an interpreter to going to Afghanistan and gathering evidentiary documents to submit to the military. And everything was done with the permission of the individuals that I wrote about, in addition to the attorneys that I worked with.
We're running out of time here, but I want to ask John Walcott about the future of Guantanamo itself. So many calls to close that place down in your reporting. I mean, what's the future of the institution itself?
Well, I think there's some big legal questions that now hang over Guantanamo and the disposition of the prisoners there. It becomes increasingly difficult to figure out just exactly what we can do with these people, including some of the alleged worst of the worst, the Khalid Sheikh Mohammeds. The Supreme Court has ruled that most of these men are entitled to some kind of habeas corpus proceeding. In other words, the government has to be able to show evidence to justify their continued detention. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be interesting to see what the response to that is. Mm-hmm. I think the pressure to close Guantanamo is going to grow, but at this point there is no good alternative to it. And I think the nastiest question of all, that occurs to me at least, is what happens if we do have to try Khalid Sheikh Mohammed under American law, and much of the evidence against him is inadmissible because of the way he was treated? What then do we do with men like that? And I don't think the answer to that's clear at all.
What a fascinating hour. I thank my guests for your input and your experience. John Walcott, Washington Bureau Chief for McClatchy Newspapers and Series Editor for Guantanamo, Beyond the Law. Thanks for your time, John.
Most welcome.
And Mavesh Khan, author of My Guantanamo Diary, The Detainees and the Stories They Told Me. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can continue the conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.